The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Love. Courage. Truth. Glenn Beck.
There's so many things that I want to talk to you today about. So many really big scandals that we're in the middle of. So many things that we're ignoring. So many things that have to be decided. And what are we doing? We're arguing about what? The midterms? We're arguing about a corrupt politician that was in bed with Russia years before Donald Trump even came. And we're not even prosecuting him because we're trying to find out how many people are in bed with Russia. We're just trying to find out if anybody around Donald Trump is in bed with Russia. This is ridiculous. What is happening to us? And meanwhile, the world is changing. And when it hits, we're not even going to be able to, we won't be able to function in it because we haven't prepared ourselves. We haven't even thought. Let me give you this. Do you trust yourself, your own ability to unplug from technology? Now, I want you to think about this. People who were born before the 90s are now wearing it as a badge of honor. I quit Facebook, you know, or they do a regular technology fast. I'm not going to use technology for the next week. Okay. How many make it? We like to think that we're not overly dependent on technology while posting on social media about how old school we are. How many times do you see people say, you know what, I took a break. And, you know, when I took a break, everything worked out. And you're posting that on Facebook. Why did you come back? Now, technology is a good thing until technology starts giving you puppy dog eyes and producing digital crocodile tears. What happens if your technology says, please don't turn me off, please, I'm lonely? Will you do it? When I first asked this question on the air, it was probably 1996, 98, and I remember the people in the room looking at me saying, that is crazy. And I'm like, no, it's coming. Well, it's not science fiction anymore. It's right around the corner. And if you're skeptical whether humans will treat robots like a family member, a new study might alter your view. Researchers now in Germany set up an experiment to examine how people treat robots when the robot acts like a human. Each human participant was asked to work with a robot named Neo. They worked to create a weekly schedule and answer a series of questions. What the participants didn't know was that completing the task was just a way for the researchers to find out what they were really interested in, and that is how the participants' interaction with Neo would affect their ability to shut the robot down when asked. Now, half of the participants were asked to shut Neo down without the robot protesting, but the other half had Neo protesting. In fact, Neo would say, please don't turn me off. Please. I'm scared that I will not brighten up again. Of the 43 people who heard his plea, 13 chose not to turn him off. Some said they felt sorry for him. Others said that they didn't want to act against his will. The other 30 people did turn him off, but they took twice as long on average to do so than the group that didn't hear the robot's plea. So what the experiment shows us, it confirms previous research demonstrating that humans are prone to treat technology, especially robots, with human-like traits as living beings. Now take this human tendency. Fast forward a few years in the future, when robots will look, sound, and act human. They will also know everything about us. Are they human? Do they have rights? If they have rights, do they have voting rights? By 2030, there will be 100 robots of some sort or another for every human being on Earth. 100. If they have rights and voting rights, what does that mean? Can we find ourselves capable of having adult conversations. We are at the turning point of human history. And very soon, the problems that we all are now arguing about suddenly will seem very, very quaint.
It's Wednesday, August 15th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
I honestly don't know how to answer those questions. But I think we are going to need to. And this fall, we're going to be delving into some of those conversations because these things are happening. For instance, they just stopped a sex robot from being shipped into Canada. It was stopped at customs. It was coming in from Japan. Why Japan is, you know, all into the sex robots, I have no idea. But you apparently can buy sex robots from Japan and have them shipped to you. But in Canada, it's illegal to have a sex robot that resembles a child. Now, Japan is making child sex robots. And there is a debate now on whether or not that would be good therapy for pedophiles. Should they just be allowed to have sex with child robots so they don't hurt children? Or will this make things worse? There's a huge debate, and the hole in this entire argument. Okay, let's have that. I think I know where I stand, but let's have that conversation. But the hole that nobody's talking about is when the robot does hit a point to where it claims consciousness, and that will come when you won't be able to tell the difference between a real human being and, you know, some sort of silicon life form in its thinking. Don't you become a slave master that is abusing these robots? Do you think if it claims to be human or life, if it says, please don't do that, and you're doing it anyway because you own it, aren't you a modern day slave trader, slave master?
Even if you're not, a lot of people will start to think that.
Of course.
I mean, think of the attachment to inanimate objects that people have already when they're not showing human characteristics. You know, I mean, it's something that's going to be a real question. I will say, and when it comes to, you know, sex, child sex robots and all of this stuff, there's a limit into which how many issues you can master in your life. And that might be a debate I just completely avoid. Is that okay? Do I get one issue I can just completely avoid?
Yes, you can.
I just hope to make noise, really loud noise, and hope I don't see anything or hear anything. Is there something?
I think on some you can't do that on everything.
No,
but I think there's some things you're like, I'm just not going to deal with that one.
If I can pick one, it might be this one.
You know what? Actually, this one is. These are the kinds of things that fascinate me and animate me now because I'm so tired of the other ones. I don't want to deal with the other ones. I'm just like, can we talk about pedophilia and sex robots, please?
Because at least it's some argument that is at least feels in the future. At least you can have it.
And it's not political yet. It's not political.
Right.
It's analytical. It's like, let's look at the facts and really have a deep conversation without somebody saying, yeah, but they're in bed with the Trump administration. You're like, oh, dear God.
Yeah, because it's just, you know, that puts you on teams and then no one makes any point. You notice this in your book, Addicted to Outrage, which is coming out in a few weeks. And as I was reading it, I think generally speaking, it's in some ways a more positive book than you're known for.
Right? Oh, it's a very positive book.
You know, you're looking at these issues and you're saying, okay, here's an actual solution. You can tell, though, when you get into some of the technology stuff, that you don't yet see the end of how that turns out really well.
I don't think anybody does.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, you have the best minds on Earth split. Some of them are saying it is the end of the human race, which I could make a very passionate case that would stand up that, yes, the human race is over by 2050. Humans will not be humans. We will still kind of exist, but in an entirely different way. I could also make a pretty compelling case that we will all be dead. I could make the case as well that it's utopia on the other side of this, but not with the way that we're behaving now. I saw something that I think is, I would say, I hate to use this word, but I think it is heroic. In today's world, we have lowered our standards so low, we've gone so low, that it doesn't take a lot to be a hero. And I want to show you something that came out yesterday, and not a lot of people are talking about it, and they should. It was somebody who is backed up against the wall that has information that could hurt somebody, really hurt somebody, and he says, I'm not getting involved, even though I know this person would love to do it. It's heroic. And I want you to hear what he said, what it was about, and his reason for not pulling the trigger. We'll do that when we come back. First, let me tell you about our sponsor this half hour. Have you ever taken your car in to the mechanic just for an oil change? Stu, you know the one thing, you know, they say that, you know, making decent money, you know, doesn't change your life. Money doesn't change your life. It does when it comes to your car.
Sure, because it actually runs?
Yeah, it actually runs. Or you don't freak out. I mean, unless you go and it's like, you know, $6,000. But you don't freak out when the check engine light goes on or when you have to get an oil change and you're like, oh, dear God, I don't have the money for an oil change.
Yeah, when you know you don't have that huge issue around the corner that's going to wipe you out.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a huge peace of mind.
Yeah. I've spent so much of my life getting into my car going, please start, please start, please start.
Or just sitting at a light and just realizing there's 25 cars behind you and realize this isn't going to go anywhere, is it? I'm going to have to explain to these people. They're going to have to pull around.
They're going to come with a tire iron and kill me. Anyway, you don't have to worry about that if you have Car Shield. Car Shield makes the process of fixing your car for a covered repair super, super easy. You can have your favorite mechanic do it. You can have the dealership do the work. It's you know, really up to you. They provide 24/7 roadside assistance and a rental car while yours is being fixed for free. If your car has 5,000 to 150,000 miles on it, it doesn't mean you have to pay high repair bills. CarShield administrators have already paid out close to $2 billion in claims, and they're ready to help you. They have helped me. I went in for an oil change with an old truck of mine, and a sensor had gone off, you know, check engine. I'm like, hey, check that too. It was like a $5,000 or $6,000 bill. And the only reason why I don't know exactly how much it was is because CarShield took care of it. They covered it. Call 800-CAR-6100, mention the promo code Beck, or visit carshield.com and use the promo code Beck. Save 10%. Now, carshield.com, a deductible may apply, but it is absolutely worth having for your car. Save 10% now at carshield.com, promo code Beck. So yesterday, I read a quote because everybody's, oh, Omarosa, does she have tapes? It's Omarosa. Even if she had tape, I mean, look at the intent behind her. You know she had this intent the whole time. She won on The Apprentice for being conniving.
Did she even win The Apprentice? I don't even think she won. Did she? Did Omarosa win The Apprentice?
I don't know.
Maybe she did. I don't know. She was on it several times, wasn't she?
Oh, she was awful. I only saw her that one. That's the only season I watched.
Yeah, I feel like she lost. I don't remember.
Awful human being. Anyway, in my opinion.
And a terrible, and should be pointed out, a terrible hire.
Terrible. Terrible.
Everybody seemed to know this in the universe except for Donald Trump, and he deserves all the responsibility for hiring her.
Yeah.
It was his call. No one else. There wasn't anyone pressuring him over that.
No fan of Donald Trump would have hired Omarosa. Nobody.
No, I think no person who voted for Donald Trump was like, hey, you know what? I'm glad he put Omarosa in there.
Right.
Everybody on earth knew it was a bad idea, except Don for some reason.
Okay. So everybody's talking about these tapes. Well, there's somebody else that was on the Celebrity Apprentice who spent time with Donald Trump. And I happen to know that he, A, feels passionately about Donald Trump, not in a positive way. He thinks Donald Trump is not the guy he would have voted for. I know that I'm sure that many of his friends would be like, you have to speak out. You could make a difference.
Right. Right.
Okay. He was asked, you know, so what about, is there a tape? I mean, you were there. Do you were on the Celebrity Apprentice. Do they have a tape? Quote, I was in the room. So you heard him say, oh, yeah. Can you tell me what you heard him say? No. If Donald Trump had not become president, I'd tell you all the stories. But the stakes now are too high, and I am an unreliable narrator. What I do, as much as anything, is I'm a storyteller, and storytellers are liars. So I can emotionally tell you things that happened racially, sexually, that showed stupidity or lack of compassion when I was in the room with Donald Trump. And I guarantee you that I will get the details wrong. I would not feel comfortable talking about what I felt I saw in that room, because when I was on that show, I was sleeping 4 to 5 hours a night. I was uncomfortable. Stress is the wrong word, but I was not at my best. Then at the end of the day, they put you into a room and they bring out a guy, Donald Trump, who has no power whatsoever. He's capricious and petty. And the interviewer says, and you have to pretend to care what he thinks. Yeah, because that's your job. You sit at a table and this man rambles, pontificates. And he's given too much credit. And because you live in the modern world, you've heard Trump ramble. You've also heard Trump ramble when he thinks he's being careful. Imagine when he feels he can be frank. And I will tell you, but I will be very conscientious not to give you quotations because I believe that would be morally wrong. I'm not trying to protect myself. This is really a moral thing. Reporter says, so just to make sure I'm clear on this, it would be wrong if you misquote him because you don't want to have an unduly have an effect on politics. If he hadn't have become president, I would be telling these stories all day long. And if someone were to say, Penn didn't get that exactly right, you'd go, who cares? But now being accurate matters. The stakes are really high. Not for me. Nothing I say here hurts my career. But for the world, the stakes are higher. He is the president, and he would be reading. And what I'm trying to do here is to tell you the story emotionally without giving you any specifics. I think this is heroic. Here's a guy, when the rest of the world is taking things out of context or ignoring Chris Cuomo, ignoring things about people who that should not be ignored, Antifa. But because they're the enemy of your enemy, you make them your friend. Here's a guy who says, I don't want any part of this. Yes, I saw things, but I interpret things emotionally. And I can tell you what I felt, but I can't tell you what he said because I don't know if I'll remember it right. Do you listen to Malcolm Gladwell's podcast?
I've listened to some of it, yes.
So his last season of podcasts
was Revisionist History.
Mm-hmm. And it was it was all about lying. And
I heard the Brian Williams episode of this.
That's only the beginning of it. Hmm. He shows that people's memories are not accurate. And he shows that, you know, they did studies on 9/11. They're still doing these. They talk to people right after 9/11. Where were you? What happened? What did you say? Who did you talk to? What was around you? Then they come back every 5 years and they say, what did you see? Well, 10 years into it, people are starting to look at the statements that they made. They made them right after 9/11. And they're coming back and they're saying, I don't know why I said that, because that's a lie. I wasn't there. I'm telling you, I was with this person and we said this. And they fully believe that that's where they were 10 years later, and they can't figure out why they would have said that. Well, I must have been in an emotional state because that's not what happened. And it's honest both times. And this, I'll bet you he's listened to the, or he's probably so smart, he probably wrote the research Malcolm did on this. But that's what he's saying. I don't trust my own memory. and I shouldn't have a place at the table. Don't trust anybody because we're all storytellers. By the way, the hero, Penn Jillette. So here we are facing some really huge problems, some ethical decisions that absolutely have to be settled. And I truly believe that everything boils down to the Bill of Rights. I believe that everything boils down to this. Are we a collective or are we individuals who are trying to live with one another? Are we so convinced that we are right? Are we the scientists who say there is no such thing as intelligent design? Okay. It's only the Big Bang. Well, what kicked off the Big Bang? Well, there is no God. Well, how do you know that? We've become so sure of ourselves that we don't even take time to step back a second and go, wait a minute, does this argument really even matter? Does this argument do anything? Are we ever going to be answering that question? I mean, by default, and you could say, well, that's the trick. Or you could look at it from a person of faith and say, that's the point. You're never going to be able to prove God. That's what faith is there for. We're trying to teach ourselves how to have faith in things that are unseen. Is that important? I think it is, because it, at least for me, it gives me the opportunity to believe that tomorrow will be better. Because if I lose faith, I lose hope, and then there's nothing. Then tomorrow is just really bleak. But I have faith, which gives me hope. And you can't prove that or disprove that. And yet what we're doing is we're categorizing everybody, because you have to. If you're going to be a collective, then everyone has to have a label. I keep all of these people over here and all of these people over here. When Penn Jillette was asked this question, saying you're skeptical that there's been a shift, which has been attributed to Trumpism, in those people's willingness to believe things that are at odds with the facts. Penn responds, but when you say these people, you're making a huge error, because there are no these people. They don't exist. You hear stuff like Trump supporters are homophobic, Trump supporters are misogynistic. This is a mistake, and it was made by the Democrats when they accused Trump supporters of being things that Trump supporters knew they weren't. They are Trump supporters that have there are Trump supporters that have best friends who have gay sex. They do. And so you can't put they type of thing on that. For 50 million years, our biggest problems were too few calories and too little information. For 50 years now, our biggest problem has been too many calories and too much information. So what are we going to do? So how do we adjust? The first thing is, going back to Malcolm Gladwell, is stop being so arrogant that we are right. For instance, Stu, you and I were together on 9/11.
Well, not together. We were on the phone.
Well, we were a couple.
Well, yeah. yeah, we were on the phone, right, prepping the show for the day.
Okay. And we were on the phone when the second plane hit.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
We were on the phone talking about the first plane because it was on the news already.
Correct.
And the second plane hit. We were still on the same phone call was still going on.
We were talking to each other when the plane hit.
Right. And we were not. You had clicked over to take another call. So you were on the phone, I think, with Tanya.
Tanya called.
Yeah.
Me.
And you were talking to her when that happened, because I remember being on the phone with no one and then screaming God knows what to my wife, who was in the other room, I think in the shower. But you've told the story of 9/11 before, that we were on the phone, we were talking to each other, and we weren't actually at that moment talking to each other.
No, I would have never remembered that.
Just moments after.
Yeah,
we were. And but that is, there's certain points of that day that to me are complete perfect videos of what happened. But in reality, that's not the way your memory works.
Did we watch the World Trade Center, the first one, come down together? Did we watch it? Did we see it?
I've obviously seen it 1,000 times, but I don't know that I saw it live.
Okay. My memory is we were in the car. We went in together.
We did, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know why we even did that or where we met, but we were going in together and we heard it come down on the radio. We were listening to WFLA.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're, yeah. Yeah.
But and then we got in and we saw the replay of it coming down.
Yeah.
But we didn't see it come down together.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Now, this is something neither of us really remember for sure all the details. And this is something that changed our lives. I mean, our entire job changed on that day. Mm-hmm. And we have done nothing for the last 20 years other than kind of study the ramifications of that event. How many people claim that they absolutely know these things? But they don't.
Yeah. You mentioned the people who wrote down on 9/11. They were interviewed on 9/11 or 9/12, wrote down where they were on those days. 5 years later, asked the same question, where were you on those days? Tell a totally different story. Then are shown in their own handwriting the story that they wrote the day after. And they say the old memory, the thing I said on 9/12/2001 was wrong. The new memory that I have now is the right one.
How do you explain that?
It's incredible. And, you know, you could, of course, come up with anecdotal evidence on this, but it's something like 60% of these memories on these, they call them flashbulb events, mm-hmm. 60% of these memories are wrong in some way.
So those are flashbulb events. Those are things that a flash goes on and you remember it because it was, you know, the day Kennedy was killed, the day Reagan was shot, the
moon landing.
Mm-hmm. You remember where you were because a flashbulb went off and captured it. 60% of the memories are wrong. Imagine the non-flashbulb events where you were just there and you were like, oh, I think that's pretty much what it is. And it's not nefarious. People don't necessarily change it for nefarious reasons. It's just decay in telling the story over and over again. It just decays in your mind.
And when those big events, you mentioned the first tower coming down. Well, I have seen the first tower coming down. I've seen it 1,000 times. I was just at the 9/11 Museum a few weeks ago and saw it again, 10 times probably while I was there. So I don't know that my brain over a 20-year period is able to sort out when the first time I saw that was and where I was. Even though in my head, I kind of feel like I kind of remember standing there watching it, but it was probably a replay, right? We get so confident in our own memories, and that was kind of the point they were making on this particular one, was with Brian Williams. They went through numerous examples of, Brian Williams, if you remember, he said he was hit. He was shot at the helicopter, and his helicopter was hit over, and it destroyed his career.
Mm-hmm.
And they went through tons of examples of the same type of thing outside of politics, outside of a guy trying to puff up his own chest or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they show you that this happens all the time to people.
All the time.
And in his story, they had it as it evolved. He told the story and it slightly changed over time.
Yeah. And they said
that's how they say it happens.
It was first. The truth was he arrived hours after a helicopter was shot down. And he told it that way several times. Then it became the lead helicopter was shot down, mm-hmm. and he landed shortly after. Then it was his helicopter was shot down, but it took years, and they documented through Malcolm Gladwell all of the slight changes to the story where you get to the point to where, no, that I swear to you, that's what happened. No, it didn't. And it's not nefarious.
I mean, certainly people do lie about things like this. And Brian Williams kind of came out afterwards and said, yeah, I guess it was my ego that got in the way. He basically admitted to it. And Gladwell's case is actually he shouldn't have admitted to it. He probably didn't do it. He probably just didn't understand it. And I don't know maybe whether that's true with Williams or not. I don't know. But I know that it does. I mean, scientifically, statistically, happens to people all the time. And so instead,
60% of flashbulb memories.
That's an incredible number. I would have never thought it was that high. I know that when there are certain moments in my life that I look back and I know what happened with 100% certainty.
They say almost all of your childhood, your earliest memory of being a child, the earliest memory is not true.
So like the first thing that you can actually remember.
The first thing that you can remember, especially if you're somebody who says, I remember when I was 2. I know I remember my mother coming to the crib. They're saying most of those are not true.
This is Pat Gray, of course.
He has a
2-year-old memory.
Yep.
And he's very specific about it.
I told him, I said, there's a very high probability. It's like almost 100% of those are not true. I said this, and he's like, absolutely not. I remember it, Glenn. I remember it. I'm like, I know, and I'm not saying that you're lying.
Right.
I'm saying here's the research that is showing that this is how that memory came to be. And he's like, that happened.
And combining these two topics, we've been on a little bit this hour. You know, they're talking about this tape, right, that comes out supposedly with Donald Trump having said some racial slur. At the same time, there's technology being developed and is at a very, it's in its infancy at some level, but they give you the ability to create a person saying anything, just created out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's technology that we've played with a little bit on the air, mm-hmm. and you can make someone say mm-hmm. something they didn't say.
Called deep fakes.
Yeah, deep fakes for video, and mm-hmm. There's a couple companies that are attempting to do this, and you know, their explanation as well. You know, if someone loses their voice in some accident, this would mm-hmm. give them a chance to speak again in their mm-hmm. own voice. It would be amazing, and there's mm-hmm. good applications for it.
Mm-hmm.
But point is, think about the combination of a fake tape that maybe you even know initially is a fake tape, but over time your memory is going to play tricks on you, and whether you actually remember it or not as somebody is something that was real. We are not designed to handle this stuff, and it's going to be really difficult to navigate these waters over the next 5 to 10 years.
And here we are becoming more and more arrogant in what we know. We know less and less, and yet we're becoming more and more arrogant in what we think we know when we don't know. We're asking questions now that perhaps have never been asked in humankind, except for sci-fi writers. Nobody's asked these questions before. We've not had the ability to augment somebody to make them from a woman to a man. And we're not willing to have the actual scientific conversation of what defines a man and what defines a woman. What is that? Are you physically now, because we've augmented you, are you physically a woman? You can identify. That's another conversation. But we won't even have those conversations. We're dealing with some of the biggest questions mankind has ever dealt with, and we won't have those conversations. And here's what's scary. AI is being programmed right now by people who are saying there is no absolute truth. We don't know the answers to these things, or we do know the answers, but they're new answers. They're postmodernist answers. Well, wait a minute. That's going into the baseline programming of something that soon is going to say, don't turn me off. I'm alive. How do we define if you're alive or not? What is life? Well, it's easy. You know, you were born, you have a soul. Okay, can you prove that there's a soul? Because that's what AI is going to say to you. I don't have a soul. And what kind of creator are we? Our creator, we believe, created us and then gave us certain rights and set us free. And said, live, try to live within these. Didn't force us. Said, try to. It was other men that tried to oppress us. Our creator created us, said, these are your rights. Protect them for everybody. And we twisted it. What kind of creator creates something that claims its intelligence, claims and is smarter than the creator in the end? And we believe they're not life because of something that we can't prove. I just want you to know, I am not suggesting an answer here. I don't have an answer. But we better start backing away from this blue and red argument and start looking at deeper meanings. And luckily, a lot of this homework has been done for us by the founders. It's called the Bill of Rights. A lot of those things can be solved today just by coming back together on what brought us together in the first place. Certain truths that we find self-evident. I want to talk to you a little bit about my Patriot Supply. You know, people have said that people who store food are crazy. And they've said it for a very long time. You know, Penn Jillette in this article said that this thing is going to come back around, and we're going to adjust to the problems that we're now facing. He said, quote, "I also believe it's going to be wicked ugly while we're adjusting." I think that's an understatement. It is going to be wicked ugly and then some. All turmoil is, all adjustments are. Now, we can either fear it or we can prepare for it. My Patriot Supply, devoted in helping hardworking people just like you prepare and become more self-reliant. They sell dozens of emergency food kits as well as gravity-powered water filtration systems at MyPatriotSupply.com. So whether it's a power grid collapse by outside forces or just because it does, a hurricane, an earthquake happen, and maybe there's a fire. Protect yourself. MyPatriotSupply.com. Get your storage plan ready today. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Glenn Beck.
The news and why it matters. The podcast available at TheBlaze.com. Also on iTunes. Special guest tonight, Ben Shapiro. And somebody else that I'm going to introduce you to later on today that is really fascinating. Today, the podcast available on iTunes and TheBlaze.com.
So have you heard of cryptojacking? Cyber thieves are gaining access now to personal computers with emails and even simple browsing and using special programs to solve complex math equations to gain a piece of cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. You'll see symptoms like high processor usage, device overheating, and unusually slow response times, which is like every computer I've ever had. There's so many threats in today's connected world, and it takes just one weak link for criminals to get in. New LifeLock Identity Theft Protection adds the power of Norton Security to help protect you against threats to your own identity and your own devices that you can't usually see if you're just a normal person. If you have a problem, their agents are going to work to fix it. No one can stop every cyber threat, prevent all identity theft, or monitor transactions at all businesses, but new LifeLock with Norton Security can see threats that you might miss on your own. Go to LifeLock.com or call 1-800-LIFELOCK. Use the promo code BECK for an extra 10% off your first year, plus a $25 Amazon gift card with annual enrollment. That's promo code BECK at LifeLock.com. Terms apply.
All right. Today's segment of Postmodern Geometry, the hashtag MeToo dilemma. Here is the problem of the day. We have a lesbian humanities professor at an elite university who is sexually harassing a gay male student. Who is the victim? You don't need that much time, right? Of course, it's the professor. Her name is Avital Ronell. She's 66 years old, professor of German and comparative literature at New York University. She apparently is the real victim, even though she allegedly sexually harassed a former student. The New York Times wrote about the whole ordeal in an article titled, "What Happens to Hashtag Me Too When a Feminist is Accused?" Well, we all know the feminist is in the right. Ronell, quite publicly, has been accused of sexually harassing Nimrod Reitman, 34 years old, graduate student and currently a visiting fellow at Harvard. Now, Ronell is an academic rock star, as one colleague described him, one of the very few philosopher stars of the world. But the investigation concluded that the teacher, the professor, was the one responsible for sexual harassment, both physical and verbal, to the extent that her behavior was sufficiently pervasive to alter the terms and conditions of the student's learning environment. So she was suspended. The accusations. Reimann's claim that before the school year in 2012, Ronell invited him to stay with her parents in Paris for a few days. The day he arrived, she asked him to read poetry to her in her bedroom while she took an afternoon nap. He said, that was a red flag. But I also thought, okay, you're here, let's not make a scene. Then, he said, she pulled him into her bed. She put my hands onto her breast and she was pressing herself, her buttocks, onto my crotch. She was kissing me, kissing my hands, kissing my torso. That evening, a similar scene played out again, he said. From emails that he produced, I woke up with a slight fever and a sore throat. I'll try very hard not to kiss you until the throat situation receives security clearance. This is not an easy deferral. Another email. Time for your midday kiss. My image during meditation. We're on the sofa, your head on my lap, stroking your forehead, playing softly with your hair, soothing you. Headache gone yet? Yes. Most startingly is the one from 50 of her colleagues, all the educators from around the globe. Quote, although we have no access to the confidential dossier, we have worked many years in close proximity to the professor and have accumulated collectively years of experience to support our view of her capacity as a teacher and a scholar, but also someone who has served as a chair of both the departments of German and comparative literature at New York University. We've all seen her relationship with students, and some of us know the individual who has waged this malicious campaign against her, end quote. So the student has been expelled. The professor is fine. Now, want to take a guess where she stands on Trump? She didn't like Donald Trump. She says, I take it as rigorously necessary that Trump's mouth hole be the flapping aperture to funnel floods of racially unleashed aggression, the toxic spill of his language, part of the recourse to crucial intersection where Twitterature meets something else. So here we have somebody who is too important to the cause, sexually assaulting someone, a young gay man, and she gets a pass because, well, she's in the right club. She's absolutely in the right club, and she's too important to lose.
It's Wednesday, August 15th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So, we have somebody on the phone, and I haven't talked about her yet because I just want to ask her myself one last time before I introduce her. Give her the opportunity to back out because I don't think this is going to go well for her career unless we change her name. This is how crazy things are have gotten. Can we bring her on real quick? Is she there?
Yes, I'm here.
Are you sure you want to have this conversation on the air? I know the rules of not saying where you work, but you're willing to put your name out there, which, I mean, you know, there's this private eye called Google that will find you quickly. And I don't think this is going to go well for you in the long run. I appreciate it. I want to tell your story. But are you sure?
I have been praying for a couple of days about it, and I really feel like I'm supposed to be here giving hope to other conservative professors, giving hope to conservative parents who are worried about sending their kids off to college, that I'm here to speak truth, but I also need to be respectful of the place that I work and the people I work with. And so it is a very difficult decision. So I agree. Okay. You're right. It is a risk.
I know you want to give your name, but I'm not going to give it. If you at some point want to give your name, that's fine. But
I think
that's just opening up a world of hurt that you don't need to go through. You are a psychology professor.
Yes.
And you have been an adjunct professor at a good college, and you're looking for full-time work, and you don't think it's going to happen because of what colleges are like right now. Do I have that
Definitely.
Right?
Yes, because there's a very clearly documented hiring bias both an anti-conservative hiring bias and an anti-Christian hiring bias, particularly in the humanities and social sciences, which is where psychology falls.
Okay. You have been teaching over the past 8 years, and you have said that there is a shift in attitude, even by the students now. Can you tell me about that?
Definitely. When I first started teaching, it was exactly what I pictured as far as the dynamic between the professor and the students, where there was a clear distinction in roles, there was respect, and over the last, say, 3 to 4 years, I've noticed a shift where progressively students are becoming more emboldened. They see a blurring between the lines. There's less respect for me as an authority figure, and they feel like they can just challenge me. They rarely do it in class. Most of the time, they do it online. So they'll send me an email, or they'll post something in the end of class survey, which is supposed to be anonymous. But they're, and some of them have gone to the administration behind my back to try to, you know, complain or what have you, because they feel that I'm too strict, or they want to have accommodations where accommodations aren't due. So it's become more of a place of incivility on the student's part. Luckily, I've been able to manage it pretty well, and it hasn't escalated to the point where some professors, say like the professor at Berkeley who had students disrupt the final exam to protest it, or Brett Weinstein who had his class, you know, disrupted by protesters. I haven't experienced anything like that. Most of the time, the students are good in the classroom. It's outside of the classroom, especially when they feel emboldened by being able to post online or, you know, do something anonymous.
You were teaching an undergraduate course on research methods, and you said, okay, let's look at the campus assault study, the campus climate survey that came out in 2015, and let's look at this. And what did you have the students do?
It was the point of the class, and the lecture was talking about research validity. So looking at research studies and saying, is this actually valid? Does the results indicate what people are saying the results indicate? And I decided to take a risk and be bold and have them analyze the campus sexual assault study and look to see, one, does it have, like, can it be generalized? Does it have external validity? And also, does it have internal validity? Do the way that they define the terms hold up to construct validity? And it was amazing to watch the class just become shocked, because they've all heard the statistics cited, but when they actually dug into the study, they started to see its limitations very quickly. And to be honest, I've never been more terrified in a class than when I was standing there and openly challenging this study and guiding my students to think critically and analyze what the study actually said.
When you say you have never been more terrified, what were you terrified of?
I was terrified that I would have a student or students in the class that would react poorly to having that cognitive dissonance, because clearly that's what they were experiencing. I was terrified that some would march out of the class and go and tell the administration, and I probably waited about a week or two thinking that the other shoe was going to drop, that somewhere, some way I offended a student that, you know, having their worldview or having this information challenged was going to create enough dissonance that they were going to react negatively. In this instance, it didn't happen, but it's definitely a risk every time I do it. And it wasn't just that one. I also had them challenge the wage gap study. I also had them challenge the climate change study that everybody quotes the 97% agree. I took a lot of risks in order to teach my students that they need to think for themselves. They need to actually analyze these studies rather than, you know, citing the talking points that the media and others have pulled from it.
When you ask your class for counter arguments to things like microaggression, what happens?
Most of the time, they don't understand what I'm saying. They think that there's just one position out there. They've never heard that there's anything else. They've never heard an alternative position. So there was an assignment that I had to use. I didn't have a choice. I couldn't modify it. But there was a question in there about microaggressions. So I told them, the way I want you to answer it is to present me both sides. I want you to make an argument that microaggressions exist and are detrimental, and then I want you to make an argument against it. And I had to provide all of the resources for them to make the counter argument, because They didn't know that a counter position existed. They had no idea how to start looking for that. It was pretty amazing to see that they weren't even aware that there's alternative positions to some of these things that have just been fed to them through their education.
So I have found, well, two things. How do we expect to have a free people and a free press if people are being churned out in colleges and universities who don't even know how to look for the other side of the story? But I have found that many times the students are hungry to see the other side. They're excited when they see, wait a minute, I haven't heard that. Even if it doesn't change their mind, they're excited about it. Is that your experience?
I would say, for the most part, that I've seen most students, when they get exposed to this information, when they get exposed to alternative, let's say, worldviews, something other than postmodernism, something other than critical theory, when they get exposed to alternatives, it's exciting to see, because they realize that they aren't critical theorists. They realize that they aren't postmodernists. They actually do believe in objective reality and objective truth. And there's almost a relief for a lot of them that there's something out there that more closely aligns with the way that they do think or the way that they were raised. But I always have a group in there that resists, that they are just so dead set in what they've been taught that anything that brings that cognitive dissonance, they attack. You know, one of the things I specialize in is actually teaching about marriage and relationships. And so I talk about gender differences, and I always have at least one student who yes buts me all the way through that lecture, because they want to deny the fact that there's anything either biologically based or neurologically based that distinguishes the genders and distinguishes how men and women experience life and filter information and how we communicate, which clearly there is. But I always have somebody in there that will push back. But the majority seems to really, like you said, be excited and hungry for it.
In the 1990s, I read a quote from Immanuel Kant, and he said, there are many things that I believe that I shall never say, but I shall never say the things that I do not believe. That terrified me. I couldn't even understand a world that where somebody would have to hide what they really believed. I thought, what kind of world, and how blessed are we that the world is not that way? We're that way now, aren't we?
Definitely. That's at least in the environment in which I work. But I would say also in social media, that's why I've gotten off social media, because that's a risk to my career. That's why I'm very guarded and very calculated about, you know, what I choose to say and bring up in class with my students, but also the way that I conduct myself around colleagues.
Okay.
It's absolutely true.
All right. I want to take a quick break, and then I want to come back. And you found, I think, an unlikely friend, a strange bedfellow that gave you some advice. I want to kind of talk about that when we come back with a professor of psychology that is going to remain nameless. This should tell you where we are as a nation. This person, I think if they gave their name, they would be out by the end of the day just for saying what she just said to you. More in just a second. By the way, more speech, not less. Sticks and stones can break your bones, but words will never hurt you. All right, I want to talk to you a little bit about Liberty Safe. Liberty's having a huge sale right now through August 26th. If you go to libertysafe.com, or you just go to the Bass Pro Shop or your local Cabela store, you're going to save hundreds of dollars on the number one selling safes in America. They are the best safe. We have checked these out top to bottom to make sure that they are the best rated safes, because we keep, you know, Washington documents and handwritten, you know, letters from Abraham Lincoln in these things. We want the best. If you do too, it's a Liberty safe. California wildfires going on. One of the customers of Liberty had a safe. The entire place burned down just recently. The only thing that was left was the chimney and the safe. The valuables and the heirlooms that were in that safe survived. These are the best safes built in America, the best safes built on the planet, bar none. It's a Liberty Safe. Go to libertysafe.com right now. Choose the Liberty that works out for you. Trust me, bigger is better in this particular case. You won't believe how much stuff you want to put in your Liberty Safe once you have it. For your guns, for your heirlooms, for your papers, Liberty Safe, always protected, always preserved. That's the Liberty way. We're talking to a woman who is a Christian, a conservative, and a university professor. She is an adjunct professor of psychology, and she currently is working at a more conservative or Christian college, but is looking for another placement and is a little concerned about it. I am not going to tell you her name. She is more than free to volunteer that if she wishes. But I think she's incredibly brave for coming on the program and saying what it's really like in the university system, especially if you're a teacher.
And you mentioned postmodernism earlier and how students don't react positively to it when given an alternative. And I think, isn't that, though, the reason why you're not going to be allowed to succeed as a professor? Because if the whole premise of postmodernism is that there can't be another option, because if there's another option, I mean, human beings are going to go towards an objective truth.
Yes, definitely. And that is something that I'm mindful of, but I feel that that's why I'm there. I feel like I'm called into this to be a light in the darkness, and I present alternatives, but I do not proselytize. I do not indoctrinate students to my way of thinking like some of my colleagues may be doing to their way of thinking. I feel that that is why I'm here. That's my motivation. So that's why I take those risks. If I didn't take those risks, I wouldn't be fulfilling my purpose.
I will tell you, the best professors that I've ever had, best teachers I've ever had, were ones where I didn't know their opinion. I had no idea. I would think they're arguing this so hard, this is clearly their opinion. And then they would flip. And all of a sudden they'd be arguing so hard, you're like, wait a minute, I thought you believed. No, they never said that. They're just arguing, showing you both sides and pushing you up against the wall on both sides. I think that is the way education should be.
I agree. And that's exactly how I try to approach it.
So you met with Eric Weinstein, and he was from Evergreen College. And if people don't know what he went through, he's not a guy who's actually, probably agrees with you on very much personally. But he was pushed up at Evergreen College, which is more radical than Berkeley, and went through hell. I'd like you to talk about meeting with him and what you guys talked about and how that all went, what advice he gave to you when we come back. We're talking to an adjunct professor of psychology who will remain nameless, and we're not going to say where she works either, due to fear of reprisals. She'd like to have a job, but she's talking about what it's like to be a conservative and a Christian and a professor at the same time. Those things don't seem to go hand in hand anymore, and now you know why she's not going to be named here. When you started looking for another job and you realized everything is a trigger, everything on my resume is a trigger to say no to, you actually sought out and met Eric Weinstein. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I met Eric Weinstein. He's actually Brett Weinstein's brother. They're right. Both a part of the intellectual dark web. Brett's the one that was at Evergreen, whereas Eric is a mathematician and economist, but he's also very much a part of academia.
Thank you.
And I got to briefly encounter him a couple of months ago, and I decided to ask for his advice because, yes, I am preparing to start looking for full-time employment, and my resume screams Christian. You can't hide it. And I brought that up to him. I said, I'm a conservative. I'm a Christian. I teach in psychology. I'm looking for full-time work. Do you have any advice for me? And he said, you definitely have two strikes against you. He goes, I'm not going to lie. You have two strikes against you. the only way that you're going to find full-time employment is you're going to have to find something and make it your thing. And I told him about my approach to teaching, that I try to be balanced. I try to present both sides. I focus on critical thinking and analysis. And he goes, then that's it. Make that your thing. You're going to basically have to market yourself as, you know, this particular approach in order to stand out. But he very much confirmed my fears that those are two strikes against me, and then I have an uphill climb in order to find full-time employment.
What did you think when you saw what his brother went through at Evergreen?
It was scary, because if you recall, that was the same time period that Milo Yiannopoulos experienced the protesters at Berkeley. So it was almost like this weird moment in history where the shift was very obvious and very clear, and it was happening at two different universities where these students felt so emboldened that they could behave this way. And then
they held him against his will in the library for several hours for a mock trial, and several of the professors that were there were almost testifying against him in this kangaroo court. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yes, and those same students held I think it was either the dean or the president of the university held him hostage, wouldn't even let him go to the restroom by himself.
Correct.
And then the security on campus told Brett Weinstein, don't come to campus because they're going car by car looking for you. It was insane. And this is not a big university. That's actually a pretty small college in Washington. And the idea that students were getting away with this behavior, it definitely is scary to think about what might happen, because he's actually a liberal. He still says he's a liberal.
He's an evolutionary scientist.
Yes,
there's like very little common ground here with most conservatives. He is he's a diehard liberal, but he's a classical liberal that says, I want stats. I want proof. Let's use the age of enlightenment. But that is what postmodernism and I think universities are trying to crush right now, is the modern world, the world that was created through the Enlightenment.
Definitely. And that's something that I've heard both Brett and Eric Weinstein talk about, is that they are against postmodern thinking as well. And that's where we find alignment, is even though politically we may diverge, they're both atheists, I'm a Christian, but yet we've aligned on this common cause of saying, hold on a second, you don't get to just redefine reality. You don't get to just redefine language. You don't get to personally choose what is truth and what is not.
He was one of the most popular professors at Evergreen. Everybody loved him. Highest marks from students. But because he said, wait a minute, I'm a scientist, and X and Y mean something. There's an X chromosome and Y chromosome. It doesn't mean that you deny that. It doesn't mean that I now have to go in with your delusion. There's an X and Y. Let's talk science. That made him have to have police protection and actually start to teach his class out in the public square, because they said, we're not going to be able to protect you in the university. It's crazy.
It is. And it's absolutely terrifying. And that's why at the university I'm at right now, it seems like the students are pretty evenly divided. So it doesn't seem like I'd be overwhelmed like I would at a more liberal college like that. But when I'm going to apply at other universities, I don't know what kind of climate is there. And one of the things that I've been thinking about is, it's not just a question of, will they even call me for an interview? Like, will I even get hired? But if they do I even want to work there? Because, you know, less than 8% of psychology professors identify as conservative. And many universities don't have a single conservative on staff, period. So that's another thing I have to think about, is not just, will they hire me, but is that an environment that I'm going to even be able to be successful? Am I going to be able to even teach?
Do you know who David Glertner is?
No, I've not heard that name.
David Glertner was actually the first guy the Unabomber tried to kill. He lives in an awful lot of pain now. He survived. He is a futurist, but he is also the son of a rabbi, deeply religious. He is a math professor. He won, I don't remember what he invented, but he invented, the cursor or something for Apple. They took that technology and made it theirs. He sued them. I think he won like $500 million in a lawsuit. The guy's an absolute genius. but is very concerned about the universities. He's at Yale now, not real popular on campus. I think he is with the students because he's so smart. But we have talked before about the university system is coming apart. It's just not going to be there, you know, 10 years or the way it is now. It won't work. And being able to do things online. Have you thought about doing a class online?
I have been asked to do classes online, and I've tried it. The problem with being a professor online, at least with the way that it's been given to me by this university, I don't know how other universities do it, is I basically just grade. There's no lecture. There's no lesson. They're given a textbook to read. They're given assignments to do. And then I just show up and grade. Mm. And that's frustrating because then there's no teaching.
Yeah, no, that's not the
TA.
May I put you in touch with David Gelertner? Because you should talk to him. He might be able to advise you. Or maybe if I'll ask him and see if he'll come on and the two of you can have a conversation, because I think it would be helpful for a lot of people who are in your situation, whether they're at a university level or not, just trying to find their way through this madness of this world and how to navigate it.
Definitely.
Great.
That sounds great.
Going to give you another chance. I suggest you don't take it, but if you wanted to introduce yourself, you may.
To be honest, it's a really big risk to do that. And like you said, that Google machine is pretty powerful.
Yep, that's fine. I just wanted to give you the opportunity. I applaud you for not taking it. Thank you so much. And we'll be in touch. God bless.
Thank you.
You bet. I cannot believe the world we live in now.
It's the Immanuel Kant thing you were talking about earlier. You know, I mean, we're really in a time where you can't stand up as a person and say the things you believe.
And how many of us are really saying the things that we believe? I mean, that's my problem with today's society is, have you really thought all this stuff through? Are you really that sure? Are the things that you're saying? Let me say it this way. I remember when I had to go on tour for the Christmas sweater. And that was the hardest thing I've ever done because it was a personal story.
I remember that. Yeah.
Of my mother's death. And
you were a wreck.
I was a wreck.
Period, yes.
It was horrible. What you didn't know at the same time that was happening, I was under the first real active death threats that I had. I was still working at CNN and I had these 9/11 truthers. Thank you, Alex Jones. Coming after me and saying that I was the cover-up guy. I was the CIA operative and the cover-up guy for 9/11. And they were threatening us. We actually had one of our tour buses run off the road. We had to switch tour buses all the time so nobody knew which one I was in. And luckily, the one that I wasn't in was run off the road. I had a guy come up into me online. The key words were all traitors. What was it? All traitors will be eliminated, I think. I had to go into crowds every single day. And knowing that there was somebody in there that probably wanted to kill me. And a guy came up and every spider sense in me just went off. And it was like, this guy, this guy, this guy. My security felt it too. They came right to my side and I'm like, I'm not going to be afraid. I am going to shake his hand and wish him Merry Christmas. And I stuck my hand out and I said, Merry Christmas. And he had his hands in his pockets and he said, all traitors must be. And he started to take his hand out of his pocket and he was on the ground before he knew it. And I remember sitting in the back of the tour bus and saying, I will not die for the things that I do not believe. I will not die for stupid stuff because I said something and I was, you know, just going off half cocked or it was funny. I am not going to die for that. What is it that you're worth? It's worth dying for. And I got through that time by imagining the worst thing that could happen. And to me, the worst thing that could happen, I envisioned myself on the sidewalk, knowing that that was the last few moments I had, and I was nowhere near my family, and I would never be able to say goodbye to them. And I imagined the worst thing, so then I wasn't afraid of it anymore. Strangely for me, I don't know if that's the healthy thing to do or not, but strangely for me, it worked. That and a pact with myself, don't say anything that you don't believe. How many of us have done that? How many of us have had to? Our last guest probably has. Not die, but not be able to work again. We're entering the time that I have warned about for so long. And I've told you, you're going to be mad. You're going to be angry. There are going to be people that want to take you to that anger and have you express that anger, and it will be the wrong direction. We are encouraged now to embrace our outrage. We are encouraged to just ratchet it up. Say it back. I'm tired of people saying and just taking the punch. I'm telling you, that is the wrong direction. The right direction is to take a moment before you go online. And I don't know if you can do this without the real threat. But that threat will come to you. And before you go online, before you start to have a conversation, ask yourself, am I willing to literally fight over this? Am I willing to literally be beaten in the streets for this? Am I willing to never be able to work again for this? Am I willing to die for what I'm about to say? If you take that attitude and you couple it with courage that you will say the things that you believe, we'll be able to back away from the edge and the precipice, and we'll be able to save the rights of all mankind, even those we vehemently disagree with. All right, let me tell you about our sponsor quickly. This half hour is Mercury Real Estate. This is a company that I founded years ago, out of frustration. I was just tired of not knowing who to trust when it came to my house. I was tired of, you know, hey, whose face is on the bus stop? They look like they could sell my house. How do you know? This is the biggest investment of your lifetime for most of us. So who's selling it? Who do you trust? We've done a ton of research, and we launched this about 3-4 years ago, and the stats on it are just mind-blowing. We have great agents that are full-time, long-time careers that have a great record in your area. We have about 1,500 agents. You can find them at realestateagentsitrust.com. They're going to help you sell your house. They're not going to just take your house sight unseen and go, yep, I'll represent you. You need to ask them a question. What is your marketing plan? Why is my house worth this? What is the market doing? What's it going to look like in 6 months, do you think? Find the people that can really answer that with the background that gives you the trust that they actually know. We've done the background checking for you. If you need a real estate agent, go to realestateagentsitrust.com. realestateagentsitrust.com. On a personal note, there are many times, in fact, almost all of the time, what you hear is my opinion and nothing more. There are other times that I feel that there is more to it than that. And what I just said just a few minutes ago is one of those times, and I haven't felt that in a while, that is more than just my opinion. It is a warning and a plea to not go over the cliff with the rest of humanity. So if you know what that means, you know what I'm talking about, please go back and review that. You know, there's a Harvard is now calling for blacklisting Trump officials. And I want to get into this next. They want to make sure that anybody who served in the Trump administration, anybody, is never offered any job in academia. Now, This coming from a group of people that have embraced Bill Ayers. They're saying the Trump officials, any of them, should be blacklisted and treated civilly, but blacklisted. We'll get into that next. Jason Richwine wrote, last year I collected several examples of we support free speech, but style statements, with the point being that the speakers don't actually support free speech. Writing in the Boston Globe on Monday, Harvard economics economist Danny Roderick follows the similar template. Quote, the Trump administration confronts universities with a serious dilemma, he says. On one hand, universities must be open to diverse viewpoints. You feel it coming? But Trump administration officials are tainted. They should be treated civilly in their public appearances, but academia should never grant them faculty appointments or even university-sponsored speaking engagements. Now, that sounds very open-minded. Doesn't it to you, Stu?
So much.
This is coming from a group of people that, A, should know about the whole Galileo thing. You know, Galileo said, you know, the earth isn't flat. It's a square. And so they put him up in a tower. And because they couldn't have him teaching something that wasn't the agreed upon science, because at the time the political power was the church. Let me say that again. The political power was the church. Didn't make church evil. Made the political power, being the church, evil. That's really bad what happens when you start to have a church state, a state church, a state religion, whether that religion is Catholicism or environmentalism or progressivism or postmodernism. That's usually bad. So they fail to see that the reason why people have tenure is to avoid the Galileo issue. They fail to see that when the Nazis came in, the first thing they did was start getting rid of all of the teachers that disagreed with them, all the professors. Same thing with Stalin and communism. Yeah, you've got to go. You can't be training young minds. So what did they do? They made people politically correct. Politically correct. It's amazing how we just say PC and political correctness, and we don't really understand what that means. It means you must be correct with whoever has political control. That's a bad thing. And that is exactly what our founders knew. Our founders had looked and searched throughout history and said, okay, who did it right? Who did it wrong? What survived? What didn't? What allowed maximum freedom? And how did that erode? So they actually did studies. I know it's crazy. And what they were looking for was any system that worked. And they found that man could indeed rule himself, but there had to be a lot of rules, because there would be people that would rise up and say, look, you're tired, you're sleepy, you don't want to do it yourself. You need a safety net. I'll be here to provide one for you. And so they built our government around the idea government shouldn't provide these safety nets for you. You have your churches do that. You can have your own community do that. You can have your town do that. I don't care how you do it, but the federal government, its job is to protect your rights. And you're all going to disagree, because somebody's going to say, no, it's my church that is the right one. You're going to go to hell if you don't join my church. And another church is going to say, no, it's my church that's right, and you're going to go to hell. And so the idea is, hey, we don't pick a side on churches, okay? We do pick a side on right and wrong, because there is absolute right and wrong. In fact, our laws were established on the template of the Judeo-Christian laws.
So you're saying we're a church?
No, I'm saying forget about God in the Bible. Just read it. At what point do you take all of the, you know, magic out of it? I don't believe in all the magic. Okay, just look at the principles. Do the principles work? Do the principles of the way God supposedly established through magic, that he established his people, did those things work? We argue about gerrymandering. You know why gerrymandering is wrong? It's not a biblical principle. Stakes are. In fact, it's what Jefferson and Adams said would be the reason we would probably break down, because they didn't do it the way it says in the Bible. Which stakes mean when there's 50 people or 500 people, doesn't matter, that's a stake and it's just a square. And when there's more than that, then you split that stake and you grow it to another 5,000 people. And then when that square is full of 5,000 people and there's more, you split it again. So there's no gerrymandering. It's just these are the people that live around each other, period. Gee, that would solve gerrymandering, wouldn't it? Yeah, that's a God principle. I'm sorry, it's a magic book principle. But the magic book actually works. So here's a group of people that originally universities were set up by churches to be able to teach. The universities here in America were the reason. These guys, they were the reason we kept it for so long, because they were teaching along with the churches true principles and how to think, not what to think, how to think. It's the Enlightenment. Use science and reason. Couple that with your faith. But let's make sure that it's provable. Let's make sure that this is scientific. It's not just, yeah, well, he says it's right and he's in the right party because he's wearing the right color. Let's have reasoned discussion on it. The people at the universities, they have forgotten about Galileo. They have forgotten about Stalin. They have forgotten about the purges, the university purges in Germany and in everywhere else where a dictator takes control. They have forgotten about the blacklist. You remember when a blacklist was a bad thing? Hey, we don't want to create a blacklist. Is there some sort of a blacklist going on here? Now they're saying the Trump administration poses a serious dilemma for universities. We have to have open and diverse viewpoints, but because those officials are tainted, we should never grant them faculty appointments or even university-sponsored engagements. So in other words, let's put together a blacklist. And these are the people teaching our children? I mean, they cause me no fear, because in the long run, they always lose. I mean, it may take us 100 years, but they will lose. Truth will always set you free. And they are not teaching truth. They are not teaching true tolerance of opinion. And I'm sorry, there is no line on freedom of speech. I don't have to tolerate it. You don't have to tolerate mine. But there is no line where you can shut me up. More ideas, not fewer. Big ideas, not smaller. More voices, not fewer. That's the American principle that brought us here and brought humanity out of the darkness. Do you think you're more like the freedom fighters in the Dark Ages? Do you think you're more like Galileo, or you're more like the church when you say, lock them up, keep them quiet, don't let them speak? Which one are you more like? Are you more like McCarthy or the people that went to jail because they believed something? Which one are you? Are you more like the university professor that was Jewish and just was teaching and doing his job and he was great, but because he was a Jew, he was escorted off campus because he's just teaching Jewish stuff? Are you more like the Nazi or the professor who's like, I've done nothing wrong, it's who I am? Which one when you're proposing your blacklist? So I have no fear that that kind of fascism loses in the end. I do fear the battle. But if the battle is to be had, the battle will be had, and it will, our children will be stronger because of it. Perhaps our great-great-grandchildren will be. Because sometimes darkness lasts longer than a lifetime. But I still have hope that people will stand in line with common sense and common principles, the principles being the Bill of Rights. But I just want to point out to the Harvard intellectuals who are so much more well-educated than I am. They can use big words and all the best words. They have the best education and the best friends and the best connections and the biggest words. So they're much smarter than I am. But I have... While I'm not afraid of you, I am you. It makes it difficult for me as a human being not to be pissed as hell at you because you are so arrogant. You don't even see your own hypocrisy. Oh, we can't have the blessed university tainted by people, except you hired Bernadine Dorn. She was on the most wanted list. Bill Ayers, most wanted list. They were terrorists. Well, they were fine for Northwestern and University of Illinois. They were fine. Another Weather Underground woman, Kathy Boudin. She was second degree murder. She went to jail for killing police officers. Well, yeah, but when she got out in 2003, after serving a 20-year sentence, by 2008, she was the scholar in residence at Columbia Law. Don't talk to me about not tainting your blessed university. How about Howard Metzinger? He tried to blow up the Detroit Police Department, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Or Erica Huggins. She's one of the leading Black Panther radicals. She's at Cal State. That didn't even bring me to people like Ward Churchill. It doesn't even bring me to people like Peter Singer, who says, I'm sorry I said you could kill your born child until they were two. I shouldn't have put a time on that. So don't talk to me about tainting your blessed university. You've worked with the worst of the worst. You have promoted and cleansed clean terrorists from other countries, terrorists from our own countries. But those people who now work for Trump, well, that's that's a little over the line. By the way, Ben Shapiro is going to be on with us today. Ben Shapiro and Jeremy Boring. Jeremy is the guy who started Friends of Abe years ago, the Hollywood Keep It in the Closet group that had to meet in secret rooms because they were conservatives.
Big part of Prager University, too, right?
Yeah, big part of Prager University. They're going to be on with us. The news and why it matters today, 5:30 on the Blaze TV, also available on iTunes as a podcast. You don't want to miss it. Ben Shapiro tonight. It's going to be good. All right. Sponsor this half hour is the Palm Beach Letter. Wanted to share some feedback from Tika Tiwari's crypto course. 97% of the people who have taken this have given the course a 4 or 5 star rating. Some of the comments, great intro to crypto. Barton wrote in, very well put together, informative. I now understand the technology and the process much better. I love this one. I'm 67 years old and I'm hoping to retire someday. I live paycheck to paycheck and have just a cursory knowledge of how the stock market works. I leave that to my retirement guy. I was getting in over my head when I started this. I was convinced. I'm glad I took the course. I now know what cryptocurrency is. I now know what blockchain technology is and how it works. I'm way ahead of the game now, even just in the last couple of weeks. Thanks, Janelle. If you want to understand the world that we're entering with cryptocurrency and blockchain and what it means and why blockchain is more than just cryptocurrency, you need to take the Smart Crypto Course. It's available now at smartcryptocourse.com. That's smartcryptocourse.com. Or you can call 877-PBL-BECK and get more information. It's smartcryptocourse.com. Let me go to Dan in California. Hello, Dan. You're on the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, Glenn. How you doing?
Very good.
I just wanted to tell you, man, you know, earlier you were talking about how, you know, people wondering what they would stand up for, what they would die for, and what they believe in, and couple that with courage. You know, lately, you know, I hear that frustration in your voice, man, and I just want to let you know, for people like me, you are impacting other people in a really positive way and really helping people like me answer those questions, man. You know, a little personal thing about me really quick. I'm going through some really hard personal times right now, and I've been listening to you for about a handful of years now, man. And again, you have really helped me to figure out who I truly am. And when I kind of answered those questions for myself, who am I, what I would die for, that really affected me in really positive ways. Like, helped me be a better father and a better, you know, partner. And I'm just wanting to let you know, man, you really help a lot of people out, and it means a lot, man. You know, and again, I hear frustration in your voice sometimes, like, how can this be happening? And I feel the same way, man. But as bad as everything is getting, and everybody knows that things are heading in a very negative way, that is also making people like me lean us in the positive way. You know, all the good guys are going in their groups. All the lines are being drawn, you know, and people are really answering those questions. Like, everything's going on with Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin and everything like that. People yeah. are waking up to what they believe in and what they stand for. You know, like, every time you talk about all these bad things that are happening, all these negative things are happening to us, well, it's also very positive things that are happening as well. People, unfortunately, lines are being drawn. People are going into their corners. But for the good guys, for the people who really, you know, stand on sincerity and truth and love and compassion, you, for me, have been very, very influential in that. And again, man, just keep always remember Gosh. That. Always remember that, man, because every time, like, the other time when the guy who came on, who Gavin McGinnis, you know, oh, we got to punch him back. And I am a, I'm a 10-year, 5-tour veteran in the Marine Corps. I've dealt with alcoholism, Pete, continually deal with all my inner demons. And you are absolutely right, man. As soon as you start becoming those that you would stand against, it consumes you. The anger, the frustration, all that consumes you, and you turn into the thing that you were just trying to fight. And I know that's so hard, especially for guys like me, you know, who are the veterans and the alcoholics and all the broken guys. Like, that's the hardest thing to swallow, you know. But you really – and I'm an older millennial, man. I'm 32. I have 3 children, you know. I mean, I'm heavily tattooed. You know, I'm the guy that you would think looks like the dude who would be going punching around people, you know. But I'm not, and that has a lot to do with you. And, you know, I'm a better man for it, because I know what I would die for. I know who I am. I know what my principles are, you know, and that's because, again, you have challenged me over and over again. Oh, man, do I believe that? Do I feel that way? How do I really feel? Why do I think that? You know what I mean? And wow. And that has a lot to do with you, brother.
Dan,
again, just always remember that, man.
Thank you. I can't tell you how much your phone call means to me. So thank you for that. And you have given me fuel to fly on for a while. Thank you. And sincerely, I will tell you as a personal note that this is probably too much to say here in about a minute. So I've got 30 seconds, so I'm not going to even start it. I'm going to save it for another day, but perhaps tomorrow, a longer conversation of where I think we are and where I think we're going. And I only say that as a we because it's where I'm at and where I'm going. And I would like to invite you to come along the journey with me. We'll talk about that coming days.
Yeah.
Welcome to the program. There's a new poll out, and it's causing a slight disturbance here in the studio, of how warmly Americans feel towards Donald Trump.
And not just they specifically surveyed Republicans who voted for him. In fact, they even went to the trouble, and I don't know a survey that's done this before, they actually went to the trouble of verifying that these people voted for him. So they surveyed Trump fans to find out whether or not they're still Trump fans. And, you know, probably won't surprise you to know that 82% of them are. They still have warm feelings or very warm feelings for him.
What does that mean, warm feelings? That was the question?
Yeah.
See, I interpret that as, well, for instance, I always had warm feelings for George Bush, but he pissed me off.
Ooh, I didn't always have warm feelings for him at the end. I had pretty...
Yeah.
No, I went...
chilly feelings for him at the end.
Yeah, I did. And then I went and met with him, and I felt warmly about him as a person, but I still disagreed with his policies. Mm-hmm. Remember? Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't change me on how I felt about his policies, but I liked him as a human being. And so, you know, you can... Like, for... this is probably not helpful, but I don't like Donald Trump as a human being. He would not be my friend. I mean, you know, even if he was like, Glenn, you're the best, you're the greatest, he would not be my friend.
Well, he was like that at one point.
Yes, and he wasn't my friend.
And he wasn't your friend.
He would call me and I'd be like, okay, that was weird and creepy. What was that about? And I hung up the phone. So he wouldn't be my friend because I don't like him. I don't like his lifestyle. Right. We're not compatible.
Right. Okay. He's not a guy who would necessarily run in the Glenn Beck circles. By the way, also, there's a lot of people who wouldn't, you know, male sports fans.
Yeah.
People with manly interests.
Yeah, okay, we get the point.
People who don't like the opera.
We get the point. Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, I know I'm friendless, so it doesn't mean an awful lot. But that doesn't have anything to do with how I view his policy. How I viewed him before the election was a guy who I didn't trust, I didn't like, I didn't think he was of good character, and because of that, I didn't believe he would do any of the things he said he would do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, new information.
Mm-hmm.
He has not surprised me on some of the things, a character. There's nothing new there, but what he said he would do, he's done a lot of them, and... I didn't think he would. So good. I feel great about those things, but that doesn't change my warmth of him. Am I just being too nitpicky here on the word warmth? I just think it's a weird word.
I think you are. Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, why did they use that? I've never heard that used in a poll.
I mean, it's just a scale of how much you like the guy. It's just another way to measure his approval ratings. And they just did it on a scale of 0 to 100. And if you're over 51, that starts the warmness.
Okay.
And I was just, I don't know where I would, he's the only guy I think that not only do my feelings for him change on a daily basis, I think sometimes hourly, maybe even by the minute at times.
I've seen you at times going, I walk through a wall of fire for him right now. I'm so mad. I'm mad at the press, the way they're treating him.
Well, they push towards him, right, for sure. There's no question about that. And then he's done some great things, like really brave things that no other president has done, like making Jerusalem the place of the U.S. embassy. And and then he sped along that process when initially they said, yeah, we'll do it at the end of the year. And then that wasn't even good enough. He actually sped it along. They found a place and they moved on it. It's pretty amazing. And then other days, you know, when
more than rat poison.
Yeah, it's difficult. But they say like 1 in 5 voters, probably 1 in 5 of his voters have turned on him to a certain extent. I don't experience that ever. Do you guys? I don't hear from people who say, yeah, I did like him and now I don't.
Well, remember, it's people who voted for him. So there were a lot of people who were just like, I just can't, you know, I'm not going Hillary and I don't want to go third party. So I'll go with Trump, and kind of held their nose. And maybe some of those people have fallen off.
And I don't even know. I don't know if people want to say that, because then you feel like you're part of the, you know, get him crowd, because you have to be labeled. right? I'm either labeled. It's so amazing. I was labeled an anti-Trumper, which I never said I would never vote
almost
for him
a
for
never
all
Trumper.
Time. Yeah, I was a never Trumper. No, I was never Trump in 2016. I'm open to new information now,
which we said from the beginning.
We said from the beginning, you know, if he turns out, I'll be the first to say it. And I did. So I was never, never Trumper. And I'm not a pro Trumper. I'm just a citizen who's like, I don't know. Is he doing a good job? Are these good things for the country or bad things for the country? Does this outweigh this bad thing outweigh this good thing? Is it anything that I can change or we can change? No. Okay. Well, let's keep moving. Isn't that what we're supposed to do?
I thought so. It's interesting, though. I think maybe your hesitation with that poll, because the word warmness almost signifies an emotional attachment.
Yes.
Right? Like,
and but people have one to him.
And I think that's true. I think the press
is driving that even more.
Yeah.
For all the good and the bad of the Trump presidency, the one thing I think we can totally, everybody can come together on is it's been a very emotional time for a lot of people.
Yeah.
People are either very emotional about him in support and against. And I don't think that should really apply to a president.
I don't either.
We should almost never.
I think that's the problem.
Right? Like, like there is a.
That's cult of personality. That's what happened with Barack Obama. His cult followed him, would not accept anything bad about him, stoned to death anybody who said, wait a minute, hang on, let's talk about this for a second. You are calling him a liar, which makes you a racist, and it was all emotion. And on our side, a lot of it was emotion because they would just deny and call you all kinds of names, and you were pissed off. Now, the reverse. Now, the other side is so emotional. And so they just can't believe how people could be this crazy and not. And they don't realize, wait a minute, we just saw this in reverse. You should learn. Your actions are only making things worse.
You know, the last time I can think of a real emotional connection for the country to a president was George W. Bush after 9/11. Remember, he got to a point where he had, I think it was 86% of Democrats approving his job performance. That's not a thing where they actually agree with his policies or even agree specifically with the things he was doing when it came to the war on terror or anything like that. It was just like, we got to come together. I love our country. We're under attack. And it was an emotional sort of coming together for a very short period of time. And now it seems to be incredibly emotional on both sides, with very few people making individual day-to-day distinctions on whether he's doing a good thing with X, Y, or Z policy. You know, like it's not seemingly part of the conversation.
It's what they did to Reagan on steroids.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this was like this in Reagan. There were some in the press that just could never admit anything good. But, you know, you can see the decay of the press just by this. Reagan was elected by the so-called Reagan Democrats, and everybody talked about it. There's these Democratic voters who used to always vote Democrat, and they went with Ronald Reagan. 20% of Donald Trump's base, 20%, are Democrats, people who voted for Barack Obama at least once, many of them twice. That's not counting the Senate campaign. That says president. 20% were Obama Democrats. The press never talks about them. Never.
That's true.
Never. It's the right. It's the Republicans. At least with Reagan, they were at least willing to diagnose the problem. Wait a minute. There's a problem in the Democratic Party. They're not appealing to these people. They're not saying anything about that. 20%. Are you willing to say that 20% of the Democratic Party were racist against black people? People who voted for Barack Obama once or some of them twice? They were somehow or another racist all of a sudden? How does that work?
And we've seen that before, too. There's large amounts of the African-American community and Democrats who voted, you know, for banning gay marriage in California when that passed. And the Democrat, there's never discussion about those people.
No.
It's much easier.
Largest segment of people that voted for, was it Prop 8?
Yeah.
Were black. That was the largest group to vote in favor of Prop 8, if I remember correctly.
Per capita?
Yeah, percentage-wise.
Yeah. Percentage-wise, yeah.
So let me ask you, Pat, on your warmness scale, how would you rate your warmness towards Keith Ellison? super duper high, mega high.
Well, it gets to a point to where it's
pretty hot because it's like
hot,
right? Yeah, like the all the intensity of white hot burning suns, like a billion of them.
Wow.
Yeah,
because I mean he's been,
so it's pretty hot right now.
He's done a super good job. He was running for attorney general in Minnesota, and in the middle of a primary, and a couple days beforehand, he got accused of domestic violence, getting physical fights with his long-term
girlfriend
by the long-term girlfriend's son.
And the girlfriend.
And then the girlfriend confirmed it.
Yeah.
And is sharing texts with the media. Now, Keith Ellison still somehow wins his primary.
Which of course he does.
Of course, because when you're a Democrat, none of this stuff seems to matter. But would you phrase your acceptance like this if you were Keith Ellison? I'm curious if this is a good move PR wise. Listen to his celebration last night.
He had a very unexpected event at the end of this campaign. That happened. I want to assure you that it is not true, and we are going to keep on fighting all the way through.
I don't think after you're accused of domestic violence, I don't think we're going to keep on fighting is the right verbiage. I think I want to switch that one up a little bit.
In fact, I might drag you out of bed and beat your head against the...
No, Keith, stop.
What? That's,
no,
you don't mean that kind of fighting?
I'm talking in metaphor.
A metaphor.
What do you mean?
I mean, I'm going to hit your head against the dresser there in the bedroom a few times. That's all.
Jeez, I mean, oh gosh. Well, yes, Keith is going to be apparently.
So he won the nomination.
He won the nomination, so yeah, he may be attorney general.
Wow.
And by the way,
unbelievable,
yeah, believable.
Really, when everybody else is getting fired just from the accusation, he actually wins an election.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Pretty serious accusations too.
That's in Minnesota, right?
Yeah.
In Minnesota has gone crazy. Minnesota, I'm telling you. You know, Al Franken may be elected God. I mean, I think it's gone.
I mean, Al had to step down because he took a jokey picture with a girl like 10 years ago when he was a comedian.
The guy who is accused of being a domestic abuser, let's give him the keys to law enforcement.
Right.
Good heavens. All right, let me tell you about our sponsor this half hour. It's American Financing. Owning a home really hasn't been easier than it is right now. You can make an incredible investment. It is most likely the largest investment of your life. If you're looking to buy your first home, your last home, or just to refinance, the people that can give you pre-approval really fast so you know how much you're going to qualify for, and close faster than expected because the underwriting is all done in-house. All the decision-making is done in-house. It's American Financing. They employ salary-based mortgage consultants, so they don't work on commission. They're not working for the bank. You know, when the banks are like, I'm going to give you a loan. No, you're selling me a loan. I see how much this loan costs me right here in the interest. I'm not interested in that one. And they do that because we think they're giving us a loan. These people work for you. They're not on commission from the bank. They have an A+ rating with a BBB and over 1,800 Google reviews. So check it out for yourself. It's AmericanFinancing.net. If you are buying your home or refinancing, AmericanFinancing.net. Do it now. 800-906-2440. 800-906-2440 or AmericanFinancing.net.
American Financing Corporation, NMLS 182334, www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org.
On your drive home, something that's great to listen to is the news and why it matters. It's available as a Blaze subscriber, but also if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, you can get it. The all-new podcast, which is the news and why it matters. It's hosted by one of our best writers and smartest minds here, and then she drags us along.
Sarah Gonzalez.
Yeah, but today we have a couple of guests sitting in a couple of the chairs, and that is Ben Shapiro and also Jeremy Boring, who is anything but. He was instrumental in the success of Prager University. Also helped build Ben Shapiro's business. He is a Hollywood writer and the guy who started Friends of Abe. He's a fascinating guy. to listen to, and you can enjoy him on your way home today with me and Sarah and Stu at the News and Why It Matters. You can find it on iTunes. And by the way, please subscribe and rate it and review if you can. That helps move things up so other people can find it when they're looking for it. Other people can just stumble onto it. It moves it up in rank. So please rate it and review it and subscribe to the News and Why It Matters.
And one of the things I want to talk about today, if we have a chance on the News and Why It Matters, is the new charges against the evil Jack Phillips, who owns Masterpiece Cake Shop.
Oh, geez.
This is a guy who...
This is a guy in Colorado, right?
Yeah, if you remember the cake story where, of course, someone came in that was gay and wanted their cake for their wedding, and he refused, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Right. He won't make Halloween cakes because it's against his religion. I mean, the guy is consistent all across the board.
So he goes all the way to the Supreme Court. He wins the case, comes back down. Now, the one thing we took out of that, because I didn't think the ruling was broad enough, but the one thing we took out of that, it was at least this guy's protected. Mm-hmm. At least in his own personal life, it's squared away correctly. Well, no. Now, someone who is transgendered has come into the shop and asked for a gender transition celebration cake, which he, of course, again refused, and is now the same people are coming back after him again to try to punish him again.
Can we get him on the radio tomorrow? I mean, how does this guy, how does he get up in the morning and do it? Seriously, I mean, you got people who are just coming after. I didn't know you wouldn't make this cake. I didn't even know who
it's
you were.
Just
this
a
was
stunt.
A political stunt. And this guy's life is going to be turned upside down for another 2 years. I mean, it just makes you just want to say, forget it.
Hopefully it just gets thrown out of court. The Supreme Court already ruled on this. So hopefully it just gets thrown out and he doesn't have to deal with it. But there'll be another one around the
corner.
We'll
see.
It's awful.
We'll see. Hey, but Antifa is fighting fascism.